Welcome to the YYY Show, a comedy podcast about search histories, life, and
umahu,
umami.
I'm Jing'an.
And I'm Eliza. And in this podcast, we are going to talk about interesting things that we search for on the internet this week.
But first, we need to make a small disclaimer. This is a comedy podcast, and we do our best to research the things that we find.
If there's anything that's factually inaccurate, please send us your corrections through our social media channels. You can find us at YYY Show on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
I'm sorry for increasingly unhinged introductions. It is Eliza who said that.
Yeah, last week's yum yum in my thumbs was my idea, and this week's umahu, umami, is my idea, so... It's Uma Mine idea.
Okay, sorry guys that we didn't upload last week because we were just too busy. I was busy with assisting music directing for a theatre production.
Mm-hmm.
And
a Chinese musical some more.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. And also we were quite busy teaching wallflowers in school.
Yeah, we were at one of the schools teaching wallflowers.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, and then we keep thinking that we got enough time to record a podcast, and then the week went by, and then we're like, oops.
Okay.
So that leads us to today, where we are doing episode 128.
Okay, anyway, shall we start the show?
Yes. So, Jing'an, what is your search term of the week?
My search term is... space miso.
Huh? Space miso?
Yeah. What is it?
Miso is the soup, is it? The thing that make the soup.
Mm-hmm.
Then space is what? Go to space and drink miso soup.
Close.
Is the astronaut food?
No, not really. I mean, kinda.
Is it? No.
It's miso that is made in space.
Huh? Made in space?
Yes. There was actually an experiment conducted on board the International Space Station, ISS, to produce the first deliberate food fermentation of Earth. And they made miso.
Oh.
Yeah.
What? You know what I thought it was? I thought it's we make a special miso to put inside the...
their food, right?
Their spaceship, then they bring up there, then they eat.
No. They just wanted to try fermenting things
something
upstairs.
Something in the space.
Yeah, upstairs, oh. I see.
Upstairs, eh? Can go by stairs or not? How many stairs does it take to reach space?
Many.
Very many.
Yeah. So they actually made a miso mixture.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was divided into three.
Mm.
And then... one go to the ISS aboard a SpaceX rocket in March 2020. And then the other two underwent fermentation processes in Cambridge, Massachusetts and Copenhagen, Denmark. So two places on Earth and then one in space.
Mm.
Then of course, then they got the results and then tasted all.
Oh.
Then they say that the space-made miso is more pungent than the other two.
Why leh?
And it's more nutty and have like more roasted aromas and more umami taste. It even look a bit different because it's darker in color than the other two.
Wow.
Yes.
But what's the difference? Is it the lack of gravity or the special air inside the International Space Station or what?
So to understand this, let's understand more about miso.
Yeah, what exactly is it?
So let's have the miso lightning round!
Yay! Miso excited.
Okay, what is miso and how to make it?
Some bean. Miso is some bean, then fermented, then smash it. Is it? I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
Just
yeah,
making
not bad,
things
not bad,
up.
Not bad. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I imagine it's like the Chinese, we have the fermented tofu cubes in chili oil thingy.
Ah, yes. Similar to, but not the
exactly.
Same.
Okay.
Miso is a thick paste that is made by fermenting soybeans with koji and salt. And then sometimes they add rice or barley, seaweed, or other ingredients.
What is koji?
So what? Yeah, what is koji? It's my next question.
So what is koji? Koji is what? K-O-J-I.
Yeah.
Koji. I know, no. Some kind of sake thingy. Some kind of liquor thing.
No.
Then what else can they use?
It's related to, but it's not the same
thing. It's like mirin leh, or soya sauce, some kind of soy sauce thing.
Also related to, but not the same thing.
Huh? Yeah. Vinegar.
Also related to, but not the same thing.
Then what is it?
Koji is steamed rice, or sometimes other grains like barley, that has been treated with a fermentation culture, or basically a mold called Aspergillus oryzae.
Wow.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. It's a mold, a very important one, because it's used to make almost everything that we eat.
What? Are you serious?
Yeah, in Asian food culture.
Okay.
It is used in saccharifying rice, sweet potato, and barley.
Saccharifying?
Shochu and sake.
Saccharifying rice?
Yes. Saccharifying. Saccharifying.
What is saccharifying?
It's not sacrificing.
What is saccharifying? I'm so confused. So putting so many more questions. Every sentence you say make me have another question mark.
Saccharifying sounds so funny. Yeah, but you know saccharine, like sweet.
Oh, saccharine, like.
Yeah.
Like saccharine skies.
Yes. Saccharine.
I didn't know there was a... It can be used in a sentence like that. Saccharifying.
So yeah, it's called saccharification. A simple way of explaining it is that it's a process of breaking a complex carbohydrate such as starch into simple sugars.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the like fermentation process.
Break down into sugars, yes.
Yes.
Huh.
This mold, the koji mold, is used for fermenting stuff like soybeans to make soy sauce and miso, and sometimes used to make rice vinegar. That's why I say all of it is like related.
Oh.
But it's not the same
thing. So they're all related to the mold.
Yes, they're all related to this mold.
Oh.
Yeah.
Huh. Yes. Okay.
So the enzymes found in the koji work to break down the carbohydrates and proteins. Like no matter in which process, like this is the same general process. To make amino acids, fatty acids, and other nutrients during the fermentation process.
Oh.
Yeah. So, you guess when did they start using this this koji?
Very long ago.
How
because
long?
I know that they use the vinegar, right, to make the sushi, right?
Mm.
Like how many hundreds of years ago? Edo period. So, it's even before. Before. How many hundreds are what? A lot, leh. Because that has to exist first, then the sushi can exist, yeah, ma.
Correct.
Huh. Don't know eh. 2,000 years ago. No, 1,500 years ago. So, 500 AD.
Nope. Even earlier.
What?
So, apparently, right, the first usage of this koji is from China.
Uh-huh.
So, they call it chu, and it's this complicated looking word. Okay, it's like a mai and a ju.
Okay.
Yeah, in one word. So, it just is this same mo that they use in fermented foods. And it was first mentioned in the Zhou Li in China in 300 BCE.
300 BCE, I was 800 years old.
Off. Yes. Yeah, so this thing is a milestone in Chinese food technology.
I wonder how they discover it. Yeah, they are like, this thing looks slightly moldy. But let's just try it lah. Then try. Oh, it's quite nice. Then never really stomach ache. Let's use it for more stuff.
Sometimes it's just like they in a rush, right? They maybe like they cooking the bean or what. Then in a rush, then they pack it inside a thing. Then they like have to travel for very long. Then like it smells a bit weird when get to their destination. But then they decide to just eat it anyway because it's still food, right?
Yes.
Then they're like, oh, actually it's not that bad.
Then after that, observe. Not really. Don't really have stomach ache. I think can eat this thing. Quite tasty.
Yeah. I think that's the general like accidental discovery of the fermentation.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So what is the process of making miso? It's actually something you can do at home.
Okay.
So it's not that difficult.
Gather all the ingredients.
Okay.
Put inside a jar, add the mold, seal it, and then just wait. until it grows moldy, then open and magic.
Yeah, correct. Something like that. So for miso, the most common one is soybeans. Man. So you soak the soybeans for 18 hours, then you slow cook it for 3 to 4 hours, then you mash it into like a paste thing to make sure there's no air. Then if not, there'll be like weird mold growing inside.
Oh, other type of mold, which is not the correct
from
mold.
The air. Yeah. Then you combine it with the koji and salt. So you can actually buy the koji.
Oh.
Yeah, then you put it in a jar and then you wait 6 months.
6 months?
Yeah.
Okay. Then your jar put where?
You just have to put it in a cool and dry place.
Oh, okay.
Then depends on the weather also lah. Then the fermentation process will be different. Then the kind of miso that comes out also will be different.
Oh.
Yeah, so this brings us to the question, why are there so many different colors of miso?
Oh, yeah. Got what red miso, white miso. What's the difference ? Is it they use special beans?
Yes, that in some cases they use different beans as substitutions.
Special beans? Special miso, special flavors.
Oh my god.
If y'all know the reference, y'all are very young. Or y'all are a man that watch too many streamers.
Gaming
streamers. Okay, anyway.
Okay. So yeah, it has to do with the amount of time allowed for fermentation. So sometimes it's a few weeks. Sometimes it's half a year. Sometimes it's 1 to 2 years. So then the amount of fermentation will be different lah.
Oh.
Then it will produce like a deeper flavor or deeper color.
Oh.
Yeah, it really depends. And of course, the temperature that it was kept in, the vessel that is used for fermentation. Sometimes they use like a clay thing like glass bottle.
Different special pots for it. Okay.
The salt content also matters, how much salt you put inside. Also, the variety of the koji. Sometimes it's not rice, sometimes it's barley.
Oh.
Yeah, so it really depends.
Oh, okay.
So all of these different factors make the different colors.
Oh.
That is very like, you know, not uniform one.
Okay.
Because there's many different types of miso, right?
Uh-huh.
Then like sometimes the yellowish white or white miso doesn't all mean it's the same type of thing. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. So like there is kome miso, which is rice miso, and it can be a bit like yellowish white. But it also can be red, because it depends on the time allowed for fermentation.
This reminds me of wine. Like, you know, people just categorize like red wine, white wine.
Yes.
Then after that, inside the white wine got many types.
Then the red wine
got many types.
Okay. I mean, normally red and white wine is like very clear. The difference is the grape type lah.
And there's got skin, no skin.
Yeah. But like this one is like very complicated. Like there's barley miso also. Then it's like reddish, but there's also white.
Okay.
Then it's like all can produce all the colors.
Oh.
Yes. But normally the red ones or the more darker ones are because they have a longer fermentation time.
Oh.
Yeah. Then the is called aka miso, like it's red miso.
Generally speaking,
yes.
Mm.
And then shiro miso is the most widely produced miso, the one that we see the most often. The main ingredients are rice, barley, and some soybeans. If more soybeans added, more red, more brown. Yeah, that's how you see lah normally. Then the whitish one, right, normally is sweeter in taste.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm.
So it's like your experience may vary depending, even though it's the same color, your experience may vary depending on what is the things that go into making that miso.
Yes, correct. So you are better off knowing what the ingredients inside this miso.
Instead of just anyhow categorizing white or
is
red.
Equals to
or like
this.
By color.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So it's quite interesting that way. So for the space miso, because there was control groups, ma.
Yeah.
And then it was darker and stronger in taste compared to the ones on Earth. So it suggests that the fermentation process for the space miso went faster.
Faster, yes.
Than for the miso on Earth.
Correct. The red was faster, even though it was at the same time, but then it is darker.
Yes.
So interesting.
So that's quite interesting. So yeah, this is my whole search term on miso.
Oh.
I'm still inside the Japan food crazy.
Okay, don't worry, I'm also. I have a hypothesis.
Yes.
Like, is it because the miso when it's fermenting, then it doesn't have to fight gravity, so it can like ferment faster.
Does it have to fight gravity?
Because in space, ma.
Why does he need to fight gravity in the first place?
Because he's like fighting against gravity to...
To what? Move, ah?
Move, yeah. To have a chemical reaction.
I think it's more like the relative time thing.
Oh.
Or maybe, yeah, maybe there's a like a pressure also.
Oh, pressure. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, oh, pressure difference. Like, yeah, it doesn't have like, to fight so much right. pressure, ma. Because yeah. in the space...
Yes.
Maybe, maybe.
Like the bodies of astronauts also have been studied to be different.
When they go up.
Yeah.
Mm.
So space. Maybe that has to do with it also.
You know, we always say go up into space.
No.
Actually, it's not up, you know.
Okay.
Because up is, like if you stand on the North Pole, then up is different from when you stand on the equator, up is different. That's why they call it outer space, is outwards.
Okay. But to me, up means up into the sky.
Oh.
Not up north.
Oh, okay. Understand, understand. Okay.
Yeah.
Can.
Okay. So now it is time for our special segment, Three Things to Google from a Friend. So Eliza, who is the contributor for this week?
This week, the contributor is ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because we have been very busy, right? Then we go out and observe a lot of things.
Yes.
Yeah. So we collected a lot of search terms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the first one is, why are there red lights on the top of some buildings?
Oh yeah.
What is that?
Like a blinking red light, right? On the top of the building.
Because we're at City Hall area, then we noticed that some buildings have the red light.
But not all.
Yeah. And then we saw that the Esplanade Waterfront Theatre,
yeah,
that little blinking... spiky thing has a little red dot.
Yes.
Then at first,
the Esplanade itself don't have.
Yeah. Yeah. Then at first, my theory is for the aeroplane to know.
But that kind of feels weird also, right?
But it's for the aeroplane to know, then the aeroplane know about the red light for what? Like, it has to be on the very tall buildings. What? Then why they put it on the Esplanade Waterfront Theatre? It's so low. They should put it on like MBS or something, right? That's taller. So what's the red light for?
Like, maybe it's the... per building thing, but then it's not like every building also have, so it's like, very confusing.
Is it for ship? Because near the sea, could it be for ship instead of aeroplane?
Oh, maybe, maybe. Yeah.
I really don't know.
Maybe it's for the ship, yeah, because then they from afar they can see ma, that there's land.
Okay.
Sounds very primitive. Like as if they don't know, don't have any other technology.
Like got no radar or some kind of GPS system, right? When I googled this, red lights on buildings in Singapore, then they tell me, iconic buildings across Singapore light up in red to celebrate National Day.
That's not what we're looking
for. Another one is in support for Go Red for World Heart Day. Then I'm like, oh, I don't think these are the things that I'm looking for.
Okay, so I guess the answer is pretty clear.
Yes.
They are called obstruction lights.
Mm.
And basically is to just make all the tall buildings, communication towers, wind turbines, all the very tall things lah, more visible for aircraft and other flying objects.
Yeah, especially during nighttime or low visibility conditions.
Mm.
Oh, it's just for aeroplanes.
Mm.
It's mandated by aviation regulations so that they know. Because it is distinguishable from other colours and very visible at night. Then some towers, if they are very tall, they even use flashing beacons or strobe lights.
I think this is set by the whoever is in charge of aviation in the country.
So I guess above a certain meter, then it has to have it already.
Yes, correct. So in Singapore, the Aviation Authority is CAAS, Civil Aviation Authority of Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a very long PDF about all these things.
Really? Yeah.
Yes.
Oh.
Okay, so after reading the very long document, we still don't know what is the minimum height that you need to have the obstruction lights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tried my best to read it and it is too technical and I have like no idea what I'm talking about. Whatever it is, they decide.
Yeah. And if you are building builder, you will know. Okay?
Yeah. And if you want to put on a short building, you also can, because nowadays got people fly drone. So yeah, you don't want the drone to anyhow crash into your thing. That's why they put the red light also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe that's why the waterfront theater have, because they were, last time when they do the NDP, then they'll fly the drones near there.
True.
Then put the red dot.
True.
Don't bang on our waterfront theater. Like that.
Yeah, maybe. Okay.
Okay, moving on. The next question is, why can't some people, why can't some people make this sound?
Yeah, see, I can't do it.
Jing An cannot roll her tongue.
Cannot do the rolling thing.
Yeah, she cannot do.
Unable.
Yeah, so why?
I've tried it many times.
Why? Guys.
The shape of the tongue, I think.
Is it a shape born of with the it. Tongue?
Born without a
like this is a muscle. You're missing a special muscle. You say shape of tongue, ah? I say special muscle. You must have a special muscle to eat. Like, you know, some people can pop their ears or something.
I can't.
Okay, let's Google
born
it.
Born this way.
Roll their R's. It's called roll their R's.
I just type, why can't some people R.
I put, why can't some people, then it helped me autocomplete. Autocomplete gives me a lot of funny questions when I type, why can't some people? God, why can't some people burp? Why can't some people float? Why can't some people whistle? Why can't some people swim?
People often worry that their inability to trill is genetic. But the reason some people struggle with the trill is simply that it's not obvious how to do it. Okay, you teach me, I'll teach me, come.
Huh? It's not obvious how to do it. Huh? But I naturally did it when trying to imitate, for example, a motorcycle or a car when I was a kid. Eh.
So hard. No. How?
Can everyone roll their R's? The short answer is yes, you can roll your R's. But there is a rare medical condition that inhibits mobility of the tongue. Then if you have this case, then you cannot roll your tongue and your R. It's called ankyloglossia, known as tongue tie. That means there is a membrane that connects the underside of the tongue to the floor of the mouth, and it's very short and thick that they can't even move their tongue properly. So if you don't have that problem, then this website says you can roll your R.
Okay, so it says, right, you have to imagine that you have a spoonful of peanut butter stuck to the roof of your mouth. Then with the tip of your tongue, reach far back into your mouth and scrape forward as if you're trying to remove the peanut butter. Okay.
Huh? Okay.
Did it.
Move slowly and pay attention. Okay, I'm doing it with you. Okay.
Okay, so then you're supposed to feel your palate change from the soft in the back to the hard in the front.
Okay.
Okay. Then you're supposed to feel your tongue pass over the ridge that is behind your teeth.
So many steps, yeah? Okay.
That thing is called the alveolar ridge.
Okay.
And then onto the back of your upper teeth.
Okay.
So we're supposed to educate ourselves on that, where is the ridge.
Okay.
Okay, then we're supposed to vibrate your tip of the tongue against the alveolar ridge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You just blow and you just blow air and let it flap in your mouth. No, your tongue must be flexible.
It's not happening, guys. It's not happening.
Yeah, you just have to vibrate your tongue. You can say brr, right? You can say brr, brr, brr.
Yeah, but I'm doing that with my lips.
Brr. So now you say tru, tru,
tru, tru, tru.
You brr again, you brr.
Brr, brr.
Then now you tru.
Tru. It's not happening, guys.
Start by saying shh.
Then say it again.
This is another exercise already, okay?
Okay. Start by saying shh.
Shh.
And then, now say it again, but this time cut the sound off midstream just by using your tongue.
Shh. It must be up. Your tongue must touch the top of your mouth. One eternity later. Okay, stop.
I'm using my lips.
I know you use your lips to first. Then you use the same vibration on the inside.
I can't.
5 minutes later.
This is not happening. Okay,
it's not happening. I think she needs much more practice.
Are you sure that I just need practice or is it I can't do it?
But the website say you can.
Okay, I will try, okay? I will report back in a month's time. Unless somebody has a physical impediment, everyone has the ability to produce that sound.
Oh.
Polish native speaker here on Reddit. I have always been unable to produce the trill, which is the only rhotic we have, despite everyone around me pronounce it correctly. So he used a different trill instead.
Oh.
Uvula trill. Maybe it's the lip thing.
The BBC Science Focus say it's a misconception that some people are destined never to roll their R's. Like, if you don't have a physical impediment, you will be able to do it. But be prepared for hours of practice. So you're not going to do it in between this podcast.
I tried it before.
You need to practice for hours and hours.
I tried it hours.
You need to tuck your tongue behind your upper front teeth. And then you just have to relax the tongue so that it vibrates as the airflow pass. That's according to BBC.
Okay. I'm really trying very hard.
Okay, too bad. Okay. Thankfully, the languages we speak don't need you to roll your R's.
Indeed. It is fine.
It's fine. You can continue with your life without rolling.
Everybody is fine.
Your R. Okay? There is no need for it. Don't stress.
We are fine without the R sound in our lives. People who can't roll the R's. Okay. I will try my best. But if I can't, it's okay.
Yeah, report back next episode.
Okay, sure.
Okay, the next search term is, does it rain more at the water catchment areas?
Oh, a good question.
Does it rain more there? Or is it rain the same amount throughout the whole Singapore, it just that the water flow there?
Or is it because there's already a body of water there?
Then it evaporate a lot.
Rain more there, yeah.
Then it will rain more there.
Is it?
Well, I don't know eh.
Good question.
Yeah, I mean, both stay quite near a water catchment area.
Okay, let's search.
You stay quite near the Pierce site. I stay near the McRitchie site. So we always experience rain.
Yeah.
So now I'm wondering whether other parts of Singapore experience as much rain as we do.
The answer is... yes!
Huh, really?
Yeah, it rains more if you live close to the water.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's a known thing. Because when you have more amount of liquid water in a region, there is an increase in the amount of evaporation in the region.
Okay.
So that's why there is more rain.
Oh, because it's a big body of water that evaporates. Then it will be in the air.
Then it condenses
and then it comes down.
It falls as precipitation.
Oh.
Because that water vapor will eventually condense in the clouds.
Oh.
And then it will fall.
I googled. Does it rain more in certain parts of Singapore? I got an answer from Meteorological Service Singapore.
Okay, yes. I would like to know.
In terms of spatial distribution, rainfall is higher over the central and western parts of Singapore and decreases towards the eastern part of the island.
Oh.
So if you want to be drier slightly, then you stay at the east.
What?
Yeah. Huh.
I gotta ask my friend that lives in Tampines whether it rains less or not.
So not west side, best side already. West side and central is the same, like spatial distribution or rain. Gana more. They even have a graph.
East side got Bedok Reservoir.
See?
Oh my god, there's a graph.
Yeah, the annual average rainfall distribution graph.
Okay, we are very in the deep blue area.
Yeah, which is the most super, super dark blue area. Then, of course, Singapore's rainfall will occur differently from month to month.
Mm.
You know, because of the monsoon seasons.
Mm.
The driest month is apparently February.
Let me search whether the reservoir is naturally a reservoir or is it like a man-made one?
Okay, search that. But for now, I want to talk about the rainfall. Rainfall is plentiful in Singapore, and it rains an average of 171 days in a year.
That's a lot.
171, eh.
Almost more than half, right?
Yeah, much of the rain is heavy and accompanied by thunder. Wow. Then a day is considered to have rained if the total rainfall for that day is 0.2 mm or more. If it drizzle a bit, then they only measure 0.1 and they're not counted. So this is rain. Eh. They never count the drizzle days. Eh.
Yeah.
If you count the drizzle days, I think it's almost every day.
Indeed.
I mean, 1 week got like 5 days at least.
It rains a lot lah in Singapore, actually.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. I have the answer to whether the reservoirs in Singapore are man-made or natural.
Ah.
They are all man-made.
Huh?
Yeah. They are constructed by digging and damming rivers and estuaries.
Huh? It's not naturally got something there, then we just expand.
Nope.
Huh?
Yeah, but got river lah, river.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, then the river is natural lah. Then we just...
They make a dam.
Dam, and then it become a reservoir.
Yeah.
Huh.
Hmm. So, it's sort of self-made. Yeah, we cause this more rain in the nearer to the reservoir areas.
Technically, we can't cause this climate on the whole, but we can affect the climate.
A little bit.
Huh. Just now you say east side got the Bedok Reservoir, right?
Mm.
I'm looking on PUB's website and there's a map of all the reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
The Bedok Reservoir so teeny tiny, please, as compared to to the central catchment area one. And then the west one also. The west side, they have the Tengah Reservoir, Poyan Reservoir, Murai Reservoir, Sarimban Reservoir, and a super big Kranji Reservoir. And the bottom, Jurong Lake, is very big also. Bantan Reservoir is all very big.
Oh.
Yeah, then ours is the Upper Pierce, Lower Pierce,
which is
Upper
also
Seletar,
very big.
Lower Seletar.
Mandai area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
MacRitchie, all very big. Then the Bedok Reservoir is like, ding, one small little thing, so cute.
Okay, no wonder.
Yep.
Okay, now we have our answer. Okay, that's the end of our special segment. So Eliza, what is your search term of the week?
My search term is... Where did Japanese curry originate from? Why is Japanese curry sweet? From where? You wanna guess?
Is it not from India?
I mean, all curries come from India. Mm-hmm. Like South Asia, don't say India. South Asia and Southeast Asia.
Mm.
Okay, so for thousands and thousands of years, as far back as 5000 BCE already, South Asia and Southeast Asia already use spices in their food.
Okay.
And already trade the spices.
Oh.
So at the end of the day, you trace it back far enough, it all leads to South Asia and Southeast Asia. So
okay.
India and France.
Yes.
And Indonesia and France.
Okay, okay. Yeah. So where did Japanese curry originate from?
Yeah.
Who brought the spices there?
Yeah. Why is it like that? What happened along the way?
I guess it's Southeast Asia because it's the nearest to them.
Then what happened? You guess?
Then
why become sweet?
Because they put fruits inside. They
put
apple,
who
right?
Teach them this?
Who teach them to put fruits?
What's going on?
They invent themselves because they are good at inventing things.
Okay, so you think that because Southeast Asia is slightly nearer to them, then they just take the curry, like the lemak laksa,
all that kind of thing.
Then they take it, then they are like, oh, let's make our own invention. Is it?
Maybe. I think, okay, if I were to really seriously guess, I think Japanese curry didn't happen until very recently.
Okay, how recent?
Like maybe the past 100 years only. 100, 150, 100.
100 is 1900s.
Mm. Yeah. Not that far back at all. Yeah.
Mm. Then who bring? Okay, you tell me your story.
Who bring?
See, I how think, close is it to the real story?
I don't know who bring lah, but like, you know, because during that time already have a lot of exports and like to ships.
Yes, yes.
Then they will like bring goods in out ma. Then they are like, oh, this is quite nice. Then we want to introduce it to our locals. Mm. But it's too spicy. So they are like, okay, must add some sweet things.
Not bad, not bad.
Yeah, that's my guess.
Quite close. Okay. It's a B effort.
Okay, thank
you. Not there. Got the ship part is quite correct. Coming through the ship. Correct. And then add sweet thing because want to
too spicy.
cater to local taste. Also about there.
Yeah, because their taste but not so strong one. Like, yeah.
When I first thought of this, when I was eating the Japanese curry, right?
Yes, yes.
Obviously, we are not over our Japanese craze yet.
Yeah, sorry guys. Bear with us.
Yeah. Then I was thinking, it's very stewy there, the food. It feels like a stew. Then I was thinking China, Taiwan is quite near, right?
Yeah,
then
yeah,
I was thinking
yeah.
maybe it's a, like a law bug. Like a lu rou type of thing.
Yeah.
So okay. I was thinking maybe the spice is from China and Korea and Taiwan, that kind of area.
I think they have also cuisine that's influenced by that, but I don't think it's curry leh.
Because we also got sweet meat. Like, you know, char siu is the meat is sweet.
Yeah,
so I was just thinking, could it be?
Yeah, okay.
I was totally off eh. Yeah, closer to what is the reality than my guess.
Oh, okay. Yeah, more Southeast, right, and South Asia.
But who bring it there? The answer is the British.
Oh, I did not expect that.
Surprise! Also, I was like, eh, huh? Oh, what?
When?
When? You think?
I guess 100 years ago.
Slightly further back.
Oh.
You know when? In the 1600s to 1800s. You know what happened?
1600s to 1800s is a lot. It's not slightly that it's like...
Wait. No. Oh. I haven't reached the point in time where they bring to Japan yet.
Oh, okay. 1600 to 1800s is the Victorian era lah.
So like they
conquered a lot of places.
Yeah lah. Yeah. The colonialism happened.
Yes,
correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So 1600 to 1800s, right? They go around and colonize the place.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are like, wow, introduced to curry.
Mm, yes.
And they are like, oh, let's bring it home. Mm, nice. Spice trade. Yes. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Yes. Queen Victoria was very impressed by curry.
Yes. Then in the early 1800s, the people in UK started serving curry in their homeland.
Yes.
Because people bring back this thing, then they are like, wow, yummy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, when they bring it back to UK, right, then they must make it suitable to their taste, right? Because
yes,
it's too spicy, right?
Oh,
so
yes.
So they make it milder.
Yeah, it is milder
spicy.
In UK.
It's a bit like the North Indian type of curry, right? The more thick
yes,
gravy
yes,
type.
Yes, more milky, creamy, and not so spicy. Yeah.
Then because the British, they have stew, right? So they like to put meats inside.
So they kind of add it together.
Making it into a stew type of thing. And they also adopted from the North Indians who make it similar style. Then they see how they make, then they just take. So the British curry, right, is a subset of what they found in India.
I see.
The subset of which that they can accept the taste,
then
they go and evolve it some more.
Understand.
So, right, the British Navy, right, also started adding curry into their meals on their ships. Because it was very tasty.
Easy also.
Easy to cook.
Mm.
They can feed the sailors. Like everything just dump it in, then just mix. Then after that, can scoop it up and give to the sailors to eat, right? Yeah, that is nutritious also. Because all the vegetable and all the meat is already boiled inside the thing, right?
And spices also help, right?
Yeah.
So quite healthy.
Yeah, quite healthy. Yeah, so good for them. So they are like, okay, very good. This food is nutritious and convenient. Then easy to feed the sailors. Yeah. So, in the 1800s and 1900s, during the Meiji Restoration, Japan opened its borders. Then the British Navy arrived in Japan.
Oh.
So, yeah, 100 years off.
Okay,
yeah.
Can. I accept.
Okay. So, some stories say that some British sailors, they were shipwrecked.
Oh.
And they were rescued. Then, in their rations, they got curry powder.
Oh.
Then, some stories were like, no shipwreck.
Oh.
No such thing. They just go to the port, then they mingle, then they're like, yay, look at our food, we got this thing. Very
okay,
yummy.
Many stories. Okay.
Yeah, but whatever it is agreed lah, that the British are the ones that brought this stewy curry to
Japan.
Ah,
I see.
Yes.
Okay.
So by 1870s, right, curry began to be served in Japan.
Mm.
And then they are like, they learn mah, curry 是这样的 stew version. Mm-hmm. And then a bit mild one.
Mm.
Then they are like, okay, we are going to do it our way.
I see. Yeah.
But interestingly, during this time, right, the Meiji era, right, which is 1868 to 1912, curry was perceived as a luxury cuisine outside of the Navy.
Because it's new.
Yeah. Only the wealthy people can eat this thing.
Yes.
And then they also only serve it in the high-end Yoshoku specialty restaurants.
Yes, I see.
Yoshoku, the kanji, is yang shi. Yang, That means Western food.
Yeah.
So they consider this curry as Western food.
Because it came from the British.
Yes.
They
classify curry rice as...
curry rice.
Yeah, as Western.
As Western, yes.
Yeah, yang shi.
No wonder, it's still like this. Like when you go to Western restaurants in Japan, then they serve curry ma.
Then another fun fact is, there was this US agriculturalist, William S. Clark.
Mm-hmm.
He established Hokkaido University.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there was a period of time where there was a rice shortage.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, Clark, he suggested that potatoes can be added to the Japanese curry to supplement the meal.
Oh.
That's why, right, today Japanese curry also have potato inside.
Oh, okay.
There was a time...
there was no potato.
No! There was a time when there was not enough rice for the curry.
So they added potato.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
So, in the 1900s, Japan realized our people like to eat this thing very nice. Then of course some smart companies started thinking, why this one only the atas people can eat? Why only the rich people can eat? Can we like produce it more? So nice this food. So they go and develop ways to make their own curry powder that is suitable to their taste.
In a cube somehow, so easy to use.
They start to make like curry udon, curry soba. Then all this right, they cook right, the noodle, they will soak the dry bonito flakes in the boiling water to make a umami flavor.
Oh.
Then they add the curry powder that they develop right into it. And then potato starch to thicken it.
Now that it tastes a bit slightly different.
Then the udon and soba mix. Then their curry right, now got added umami flavor inside.
Yeah. Like, so it's like special.
More delicious.
Yes.
Yeah, then in 1940s and 1950s, like what you said lah, they started thinking, maybe we can make it in the block form. You know, the cube.
Yes.
Yeah. So the cube is actually powdered curry roux. R-O-U-X.
Oh.
So roux.
Yes.
R-O-U-X is a mixture of flour and fat cooked together to thicken sauces.
Oh.
Then they find a way to make this thing, flour and fats and the curry seasoning and all that. Make together, dehydrate it, boom, into one block.
Yes.
Block. Then very easy what?
Yep. Just have to buy the block.
It's not very difficult. You must buy all the different spices. Then must own self tell. Then very difficult, right?
Yeah.
So you just buy the block lah.
Yeah.
So this does not explain why it is sweet yet.
Mm-hmm. They put apple inside.
When? When is the apple? I know you know got apple, but when did the apple come in?
I don't know. Maybe they just think it's nice.
So my
they
thought
have
is...
too many apples.
Yeah, my thought is, because in Asian culture, right, we got like the pear soup.
You know
that kind of thing. Then I think, okay lah, since we got pear soup, apple soup, that kind of thing, then we just put inside.
I thought it's because it's too spicy, then they decided to sweeten it to lessen the spicy. My theory was that.
Yes, they want to use it to sweeten it. But it is not what we think.
Okay.
So in 1963, there's a Japanese company called House Foods. They introduced this thing called vermont curry. It's an instant curry roux made with apples and honey. And it exploded in popularity.
I see.
Because it is sweet and many children enjoyed it a lot.
Mm.
And this is when the curry is no longer considered to be a spicy adult dish.
Yes.
You surely see this box before.
Yes.
It's like,
I know.
Every supermarket also have this.
When you say Vermont, then I was like, oh, yeah. I've seen that word before.
Vermont curry. It's like one box, then inside is like cube.
Yeah.
Then that curry, once you mix it in, right, it's sweet.
It's so sweet.
Yeah. It's because when they made this, then they flavor it with apples and honey, right?
Mm.
Then people started thinking, ah, we can use apples and honey
oh.
to make our curry. Why use their cube to cube make, right? Thing. We can grate the apple in.
Mm.
Then we can put our fresh honey in
oh.
to make it sweet.
Okay, okay, okay. So it's the other way around.
Yeah, it's this thing got invented first.
Oh.
Then people started adding the grated apple in.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was thinking, okay, okay, fine, fair
yeah.
enough.
Yeah.
But this house food, where they get this idea? Then why Vermont?
Mm.
Why is Vermont? Who is Vermont?
It's a place, right?
Is it a person? Is it a place?
Is it a US place or is it a European place?
Vermont is an obscure state in America,
uh-huh.
bordering Massachusetts and New Hampshire.
Yes, yes, yes. Sounds
so
familiar.
It's like, okay, fair enough. So is it that place?
Is it?
Eat the curry, got apple inside.
Is it that place got a lot of apple?
No! The answer is no and no. They never eat curry, then that place also don't have a lot of apple. And I was like,
why?
Huh? So, in 1958,
okay.
There was a doctor called D.C. Jarvis. Okay. He published a book called Folk Medicine, A Vermont Doctor's Guide to Good Health.
Okay,
that's his book title. Ah.
Okay.
And it actually was so popular, right? It stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And inside this book, there was a folk remedy. It's a mixture of apple cider vinegar and honey.
Oh.
And it's called Honey Girl. And it's
Honey Girl.
A miracle cure all that I can combat see. Everything that ails you.
I see.
From arthritis to diabetes to heart disease.
Oh.
As long as you eat Honey Girl, you will be well.
Oh, so that's where the idea came from.
Yeah,
la.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, okay. This thing has been debunked already. La.
Uh-huh.
Okay, just like...
Like, it obviously does not help you.
Medicine.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But during that time, right, this thing was regarded as like a magical mixture. Like everybody oh. was like, wow, this is the best cure.
Trendy, trendy.
You sick a bit only, then you just eat, you'll be fine.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. And it actually spread to Japan.
Oh.
And in Japan, right, it's known as the Vermont Health System. Vermont 健康法. That's the kanji.
Oh, okay, okay.
So they subscribe to this belief leh, that honey girl can cure everything.
Oh.
That's why this house food, right?
When it's called Vermont curry.
Yeah. They incorporate this honey girl idea lah, inside.
It's like you eat my curry, you also be healthy at the same time.
Yeah.
Very good for your child.
Then they put a lot of advertisement, you know. Then got jingles and all that, you know.
Oh.
On the radio, on the TV, everywhere.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, right? They never use the apple cider vinegar
inside
their curry.
They only advertise it that way.
Yeah,
what?
they use honey and apple
uh-huh.
to sweeten it. But
yeah.
they also put a lot of other things, other
oh.
sweetening agents, other chemicals
yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
other
yeah.
things.
Okay.
But they just use this Vermont health system la, to
idea.
Like, yeah, market it. Like, wow, the next good thing. Excellent
oh,
thing.
So
then
interesting.
You make the curry already, right? You ownself put your own vegetable inside, put your own meat. Then your children can have a healthy meal.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Yeah, then people are like, we put our own apple la, we put our own honey. Yeah. Then it became like that, sweeter and sweeter. Then people like the taste. Lo.
Mm.
Then since a lot of children grow up eating it, right?
Mm.
Then they grow up ready.
Because
1960s, man, this happened.
Mm.
Then as they grow up, then they demand for this taste.
I see.
Then
I
the
see.
Restaurants also start making
yes.
it like that.
Yes.
Huh.
Wow.
Yeah. So Japanese curry, right, is the way it is, right? Because of colonialism, a folk remedy, and crazy viral marketing leh.
Yeah.
What?
What an origin story for the curry, the humble curry.
Yeah,
of
I, did
Japan.
Not, I did not expect this at all.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Very interesting. We've reached the almost end of our podcast, and now it is time for one thing to recommend. My recommendation for this week is listening to vinyl. I recently had a chance to go to a vinyl listening cafe and wow, it's such an interesting experience.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend it for like musicians like especially because it's like I never really got a chance to like listen to vinyl before. I didn't really think that it would be very different. But actually, the vinyl sound has quite a unique quality to it. And it's like a good chance to discover new music also.
So how is it different from like listening to Spotify or some digital music?
It's quite different, like, because it's vinyl, so it's like there's like crackles, and like sometimes the thing will run. Oh. Then like it feels very analog lah.
Oh.
It's more rich and warm, the sound.
Oh,
I would
so
describe it that way. Yeah.
Ooh.
Very interesting.
Okay, my recommendation for this week is still something Japanese. Ha ha ha.
Okay.
It's sukimin.
Ah, yes.
It's cold ramen noodles that are dipped in some kind of soup or broth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I never heard of this thing, you know. I never knew that ramen can be served cold.
Like,
until you told me about it. Like, ramen gan eh, and cold eh, and then deep inside the hot sauce eh. Like,
yes,
huh?
Yes.
What is that? Yeah. When we went to Japan, then we ate it a few more times. It's really very nice, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is very nice.
Yeah,
indeed.
But one shop even put a sign there. Foreigners not recommend.
Scared you don't know how to eat.
Yeah, scared you don't know how to eat. I think a lot of foreigners might have mistakenly poured the gravy onto the bowl.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Then it's like, what's happening?
Yeah, I think the chef not very happy about it. So to take, you know, the...
Too hard to explain. I don't think they're not happy.
Oh.
I think it's more like... Sometimes the chefs are very Japanese, ma, so they don't really know a lot of English.
Oh, they're very hard
and
to teach you.
It's difficult to explain.
Then they're so busy, right?
Yeah, then they have
to like serve so many people. Then like so hard to explain to you.
Yeah.
Maybe they should put one video how to eat this thing.
Yeah.
Scan QR code. Then you watch already, then you can order.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it.
All right, we've reached the end of this week's podcast. Thank you, Liza, for making this podcast with me.
And thank you, Jing'an, for doing this podcast with me. If you have Googled anything interesting lately, you can drop us a DM or comment on any of our social media accounts and we'll search it up on the show.
You can also follow us on our Twitter, Instagram, or on our Facebook page where we post images of some of the things that we talked about today. You can also help share our show with your friends that might enjoy a comedy trivia podcast.
If you would like to support us, you can head over to our Patreon page and give us a small contribution to help us keep the show running. And now, we're off the record. One more thing, a Patreon-only podcast called One More Thing. So, see you there!